is Northfield Outdoors, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. From hunting to hiking, camping to cooking, mushroom hunting to motorcycling, and so much more, your hosts, Dave Vesladol and Andy Beham, will enlighten, entertain, and inform you with a lively mix of guests and discussion on all things outdoors. And now your hosts, Dave and Andy.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Northfield Outdoors on KYMN 95.1 The One and 1080 AM. As always, Northfield Outdoors is proud to be sponsored by Professional Pride Realty. I'm Dave Vesladol, along with my co-host, the winning, the champion, the guy who got the most prizes at the KYMN party this year, Andy Beham.
Hey, I got to be good at something, right?
That was impressive. I mean, you got walked away with quite a few.
I did.
Well, you and your significant other.
Yeah, she claims that they were all her tickets. I don't know. No, it was a fun time. We had the station's Christmas party at Froggy Bottoms the other night, and
you know that's a fun place to do that.
Yeah,
it was just the area up there on the lily pad where we had it was just the right size for the group and stuff, and I think the entertainment, the games were fabulous.
Yeah, I think you and Pat thought so. Yeah. No, it was a great time. It kept me indoors a little bit on Saturday morning, but
yeah,
it was all right.
Yeah. Hey, a few other little things. We have a new DNR commissioner.
We do. I look forward to meeting her. You know, we'd like to thank Tom Landwehr, the outgoing commissioner, for everything he's done with the show, and wish him best of luck in his future endeavors. And
yeah, he's got some big shoes to fill. He was a pretty popular guy.
I know. Yeah.
Personally, from us, he always made himself available to us and was, I think, a pretty straight shooter. He had, I think, hunters liked him. I think landowners liked him. There was a lot of different organizations that spoke well of him, so I'm sure he'll land on his feet someplace.
Yeah, he allowed us to feel like a much bigger deal than we may be. Oh. But
well, we are a big deal.
There we go.
Hey, it's winter out there, Andy.
Is it?
Well, kind of.
Right. Well, I hear winter is coming here.
Yes, and, yes.
You know, as our listeners know, we record the show ahead of time, and it's Monday, so by the time you hear this, winter will have shown up again.
Yeah, we'll have gotten a little cold. But we're going to talk snowmobiling, specifically mountain snowmobiling.
All right.
And we're lucky enough today to have a mountain snowmobiling expert with us, Jeremy Hewlett. Hey, welcome, Jeremy.
Great to be here, guys. Thanks.
Okay, before we get started, Jeremy, why don't you just give us a little bit about your background? And I know you have a business and stuff. Don't be afraid to plug that.
Certainly.
But a little bit about, you know, how you got involved in snowmobiling and why mountain snowmobiling?
Sure, Dave. Well, I'm a Northfielder myself. Grew up here. Actually lived just outside of town. I graduated in 2008 and, you know, pursued some a business degree in school, and that's what I do now. I own and operate a small insurance brokerage, but when I'm not in the office, I'm usually out riding, whether it's snowmobiles, dirt bikes. You know, I got into that at a young age growing up in the country, and it's just kind of become a way of life for me, and, you know, it's just evolved over the years. It started from riding a little 340 Polaris in the field with Dad when I was 6 years old to where I'm at now, going out west and riding in the mountains. So, you know, it's been a progression thing, and, you know, mountain riding has just been new. It's opened the doors. It's a new challenge. There's some great access with it. You know, you see some things and you're able to do some things you might not be able to otherwise with, you know, how far these machines have come.
Now, you used to actually race motorcycle also, didn't you?
Yep.
So take a few minutes. Tell us about that.
I did. And that's where.
And how successful were you?
I raced motocross for 10 or 11 years. Started when I was about 13. And yeah, I got to a pretty high level, and we traveled all over the Midwest as a family racing. And, you know, during that time, it was kind of one or the other. It was either you race the bikes or you do snowmobiles, and it's too expensive to do both. We always had snowmobiles. You know, they were usually pieces of junk that we were fixing all the time. But, you know, once my racing motocross kind of toned down and college was winding down, I was able to finally get some good equipment for the first time ever. And, you know, we started riding trails pretty hardcore for, you know, 5-6 years, northern Minnesota, Canada, upper peninsula, Michigan. And, you know, after putting on 2,500 to 3,000 miles winter for 5 years in a row. I kind of wanted to take the next step and do something else, but that's kind of how it started. It's just been a progression.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, we don't necessarily have a lot of mountains in Minnesota. I suppose the closest thing would be northern Minnesota with Lutzen up in that area and stuff. But I don't know a lot of people that do a lot of mountain sledding. So, again, what kind of changed you from trail riding around here to actually getting a mountain sled?
Well, it's something I always wanted to do, and again, it just took some time to be able to do that, just with equipment and getting the resources and people in line to do it. You know, obviously, like you said, you look outside, we don't have a whole lot of snow. We got basically nothing now, and we've had some tough winters here in the Midwest for snow lovers, and, you know, basically, we're just chasing the snow. If you want to go find big snow, you usually have to go out to the mountains, and you know, that's kind of what we're committed to doing now. It's, you know, it's not for everybody. It is difficult. It's not just a joy ride, but, you know, if you're prepared and you have the right equipment, it's a growing segment. Snowmobiling has been, you know, the manufacturers are selling less machines for trail segments, you know, obviously due to the winters we've been having, but the one segment of snowmobiling that's growing is the mountain, and there's a lot of Midwestern guys that are doing that now, and they're making the trip.
Now, as you talk about, you know, the different equipment, different sleds, that can you just kind of break down, if I was just to take my average Minnesota snowmobile, head out west into the deep powder, how would that go for me?
Probably not too well. You know, the mountain sleds specifically, they have a much longer track, a lot deeper paddles on the track. The front ends are narrower, you know, to try to ease the maneuverability in deep powder. You know, the trail sleds we might have around home here, they're a lot wider ski stance. They're made to, you know, handle groomed flat corners with good stability. And, you know, mountain sled is completely opposite of that, really.
Yeah. So why the need for the long track?
You know, mainly, you know, when the snow's deep and fresh out there, you got to have some flotation, and you got to have some big lugs on the track to get you out of the snow and on top of it. And then, the longer track just keeps, you know, got more surface area on the snow and keeps you afloat if you're doing everything right.
So if I'm looking at a snowmobile and I'm looking at a trail sled versus a mountain sled, how much longer is that track?
So for a long time, trail sleds, the standard track length was about 121-inch track. That's what your typical trail sled is all the way up until, you know, kind of the late 90s, early 2000s. Mountain sleds now, the snowmobile I have, it's got 155-inch track with 3-inch paddles on it. And it's pretty big, and that's kind of a midline model now. They've gotten even bigger. You know, 15 years ago, 141-inch track was considered a full-on mountain sled, or 144, and it's progressed. They've gotten bigger, and even trail sleds today, you rarely see a 121-inch track anymore. Most trail sleds now are 128, 137, and onward. So it's you know, the perception's changed a little bit. The ride quality's changed a little bit with that too.
So talking about paddles, explain what a paddle is, and are there different lengths?
Yep.
And
so
what's the value of the different lengths?
Sure. So paddles are just the lugs, if you will, on your track that protrude off the track. You know, that's what ultimately is scooping the snow and giving you traction. Most mountain sleds, 2.5-inch lug height is or 2.5-inch paddle is pretty common. Goes up to 3-inch now. That's a pretty new phenomenon. It's, you know, again, even 10, 12 years ago, a 3-inch track was unheard of, and the machines just keep getting bigger, and the tracks keep getting bigger on them.
And so typically, what size motors do you have in a mountain sled?
It varies. The most popular is the 800cc line. All the manufacturers, they make 600cc's and up, usually in their mountain lines, but the 800 is by far the best selling. Lot of power. They're lightweight, two-stroke motors still, and most of the manufacturers are using.
You know, Andy, well, In fairness, you're a little bit younger than I am, but still, I remember back the snowmobiles that I had, a 440 was a big sled.
That was the racing ones?
Yeah. No, but I, you know, wow, I got a big sled.
Yeah.
And now you hear talking about 800 and stuff. It's pretty amazing how things have changed there and stuff.
When you were talking about, you know, the power to get it floating, and for people in Minnesota that, you know, haven't maybe spent time out west in the powder, I know myself, I have never snowmobiled out west, but I've skied in it. It's a completely different experience. I mean, is the snowmobile, is it almost handling more like a jet ski or something like that through the deep snow?
Yeah, in a sense it is. You know, it's so much different than being on the trail. You know, you almost want the machine to be tippy versus a trail sled. You want that stability in the groomed corners and such. But, you know, it's they respond really fast to body and throttle movements, you know, kind of like a jet ski to propel you through that snow. And, you know, it's amazing. Even with how big the machines are, you can make really quick movements and, you know, cut some pretty tight corners in that deep snow with them.
Yeah. So, I know it looks almost like a workout. I have friends that live out in Colorado and some that travel out there, and they post videos of it. I mean, you have to make a short day of it. It has to get exhausting.
It is. Yeah, it's probably one of the most physically demanding things that I've done. You know, just you're spent after a day, and, you know, and that's a combination of the actual riding itself, helping buddies get unstuck, you know, tipping the machines over, digging out trenches we carry shovels with. You know, it's exhausting when you're up at 10,000 plus feet. You know, you're ready to go to bed at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So if I brought my trail sled out with the studs on the track and stuff, how far would I get?
It depends. I mean, if the snow's set up and it's they haven't got fresh snow in a while, it does firm up over time. And if it gets warm, and, you know, if it that happens, you can go pretty far with a regular sled. But if it's after they just got a big storm and it's fresh, I mean, you're not gonna get too far. You might go for a little while. As soon as you have to make a maneuver or get into a tight spot, you might be digging yourself out.
And what about taking a mountain sled out around here? Say we had some snow out here and wanted to go on the trails. What is it tough maneuvering it around on these type of trails?
Yeah, I mean, people do it. It's, you know, you can ride them. It's not ideal. Like I said, they don't steer on groomed trails on hard snow. They're long. The front ends are really light and they're tippy, and they really don't steer well. I mean, you can ride around and cruise around just fine, but, you know, getting aggressive on it's probably not the best. And it's tough on the track too, unless you've got a lot of snow. It's tough on some wear parts on those machines.
And what type of sled do you ride? What brand?
I have a Polaris RMK.
But that's still a two-stroke?
Yep.
Do you run into any problems out west where I think it's Yellowstone will limit you. You can only bring four strokes in there. Are there other places where you run into that?
You know, Yellowstone, the actual national park, that is, as you mentioned, that is off limits to two cycle engines. And, you know, there's not a lot of, I don't think there's any backcountry riding accessible in the actual park. They do guided tours their four stroke sleds, a lot of the resorts, and, you know, some business owners out there that's what they do. They take trail tours. But I don't think they allow anything off-road, and like you said, certainly not two-stroke.
So what is the reason behind, is it the sound, the noise levels, is it?
I think it's mainly an emissions thing.
Emissions, okay.
And this has been going on a while out there, and that's one of the only areas that actually has that designation. I mean, even if you're, we ride a lot of areas, West Yellowstone, for example, is, that's southwestern Montana, right on the border of the actual park. There's, you know, tons of acreage of riding lands that you can ride, you know, the machines we have, but, you know, there's not very many other places that have limited it due to the emissions.
All right. Are there any other big differences? You talked about the track being the big difference in a little narrower front end. Otherwise, is it the basic snowmobile that we'd see around here quite a bit?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is the same, you know, just a lot longer tunnel to house that big track out back of you. They sit up pretty tall, you know, they're made to have pretty good ground clearance. You know, the motors are the same. They're all nowadays fuel injected, obviously, so there's, you don't have to monkey around with carburetor jets out on the mountain and such. So that's all taken care of. You just have to worry about your clutch setup. you know, for going different altitudes. The air is so thin. Out at high altitude, your engine's working a lot harder. It's not getting the air and producing the horsepower that it would back here closer to sea level. So just making clutch adjustments, adjusting the weights and springs. And there's charts for that from all the manufacturers. That's really the main thing that's different about them, and just getting it set up properly.
Do they make any two-up mountain sleds? I mean, I don't even see a whole lot of trail sleds anymore that are two-ups. I know they still make some, but is there such a thing? I haven't seen one.
Not for a full-on mountain machine. No, they still make them, like you said, for trail cruising. Yeah. And you see people riding them out there, and that's not to say, you know, people go out west, some people go out there to actually ride trails. They have some great trail systems out there as well. You don't have to jump off and go backcountry riding in the deep stuff. They have a lot of those areas have great you know, groomed trail riding too, and we take those trails to get to where we're going to jump off for the day.
What about cost? Is there a big difference in cost between a trail sled and a mountain sled?
Surprisingly, no, even though it's a lot more, seems like a lot more machine with the big track and all that. They're really close in price, you know, to a comparable same size, same engine, you know, trail machine. You know, the local market here isn't as great for resale on mountain machines just because we're in the Midwest, but you know, it's seasonal. I mean, it always you know, things are high right now, but in the, you know, in the spring and summertime, you know, they are a little tougher to move. But yeah, as far as new costs, they're actually pretty similar.
So what would a sled like what you have, if I was to go buy a new one, 800?
Brand new, you're looking probably around 12 or 13 grand.
Okay. Well, again, a little different than years ago. Andy, do you remember?
I think we're stuck just splitting a two-seater, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. But do you remember, I'm going to date myself, but going way
then
back.
Then I don't.
Going way back, how many different manufacturers of snow wheels there were? I think in the 70s there was like over 80, up to 80, maybe 89 different manufacturers.
Yeah.
And what is there now? Four major manufacturers?
Yeah, essentially four. You got Polaris, Arctocat, Ski-Doo, and Yamaha. Well, and that's really it.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
I think of all the ones my family has owned in the past when I was younger up at our cabin, that wasn't even one of the four. You know, there's some very obscure ones that we've had that were definitely dated machines Grandpa just kept going.
Jeremy, you probably get a kick out, at least I do, when you see these vintage snowmobiles gatherings and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It always kind of takes me back. But I'm starting to get a little surprised when and Jody, don't listen to this part, but when I look online for perhaps picking up an old snowmobile from the 70s or early 80s, how much they're getting for those.
Yeah, if they're in good shape, I mean, you guys are getting a lot of money for those. And, you know, I used to know a few collectors up north, and, you know, we'd go up and check out their lineups, and yeah, it was cool to see all the, you know, like Andy said, just a ton of manufacturers. You had Mercury's and Johnson's and, you know, Kawasaki, Harley Davidson, and, you know, those are, and John Deere, they're getting really hard to find. But yeah, they, if they're in good shape and they run and drive, you're gonna be paying for them.
I actually rode an old Rupp Nitro. Oh, I wish I had that again.
All right, well, we've kind of got into the machines themselves, so why don't we go ahead, take a break, hear from our sponsor. We come back, we can hear about some of the experiences that you've had since taking on some mountain snowmobiling.
Professional Pride Realty is a proud sponsor of Northfield Outdoors on 95 The One. Let the staff and realtors at Professional Pride help you make coming indoors from the outdoors a welcoming experience in the home that's right for you. The realtors at Professional Pride are local and know the Northfield market. Whether it's buying your first home, upgrading from your current home, or purchasing your own slice of the outdoors, let Professional Pride help you every step of the way. To learn more, check them out on Facebook or at ProfessionalPrideRealty.com. Keep enjoying the outdoors and let Professional Pride worry about your indoors.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to KYMN 95.1, The One, and 1080 AM. This is Northfield Outdoors. We're talking to Jeremy Hewlett, who is our mountain snowmobiling expert here. And we've been talking all about sleds. Now we want to really have a little fun here. Let's get into, you know, some of your experiences out west, because you head out there quite a bit. How about, what, few times a year?
Huh. Yep, I've been out twice already. Usually, I've been going 4 or 5 times a year the last several winters.
So. Where have you been this year?
So far this year, I've been out to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, both times, actually. They've been kind of leading the way in snow so far for the early part of the season here out west, and it's been very, very good. You know, last year, they had a pretty subpar winter in Colorado, but there are places north of there up in Montana, Wyoming that had tons of snow, and it's kind of reversed right now. So that's where we've been focusing at the moment.
So before we head out west, I'm going to go and buy myself a mountain sled, load up the trailer, and head out west. What are some of the things I should think about? What are some of the do's and don'ts before I ever leave Minnesota?
Well, one thing, you know,
what do I need to know?
Safety is a big thing. You know, we learned a lot the first couple of years. I'm still learning every time we go out, but you know, it's not just the snowmobile. It's not just, you know, get your jacket and helmet, throw gas in it and ride. You know, if you're going trail riding, that's one thing, but this type of riding, you need to be conscious of the safety gear that's involved. And it can be a little bit daunting at first, but you know, obviously out west, there's a significant set of dangers that aren't present here, whether it be avalanche, whether it be getting stranded. You know, you might not have cell reception. You know, there's all these things that you need to plan for. And what I would tell people is, you know, do some research. There's even classes out there, especially, you know, revolving around the avalanche portion of it, because that is the number one you know, fear, I guess you'd say, out there is avalanche. And it is a real thing. There are ways to minimize your risk, and part of that is having the right gear. So I would tell people, you know, if you can get in touch with someone that's been out there before, you know, they can guide you in a direction to get proper safety gear. You know, having fun, that's what it's all about. But, you know, we've really had to take a look at the safety aspect of it from doing this new kind of riding.
So do you carry an avalanche beacon with you?
Yep, I always have an avalanche beacon. You know, you strap that right to your body. It transmits out a radio signal and to other beacons. So it's important that you have it, but it's even more important that your riding partners have it too, because it doesn't do any good if they don't have the right gear.
Yep.
You know, if you do get caught in an avalanche situation or you get buried in snow, you know, that beacon and people having them and knowing how to use them is what's going to help you, you know, come back for more riding.
Have you ever found yourself in any close call with an avalanche or seen them nearby?
I've seen two of them. No one in our group had gotten caught up. They weren't really big avalanches, but you know, you just never know. And, you know, I've taken a couple classes. There's actually a gentleman named Mike Duffy out in Colorado. He travels all over the Midwest, and he comes, you know, in Western United States, fall and winter. He puts on avalanche awareness courses. I just did one in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, about a month and a half ago. He goes around to different dealerships around the area, and he, you know, he specializes in it. He does this for a living. He teaches these classes. He does some on the snow out west too, and he'll show you, you know, how to use that equipment and things to look for when you're out riding. You know, other than the beacons, the next step up is the avalanche airbag backpacks.
Yep.
Used to be a big thing in skiing is where that all started. But now with, you know, the way these machines have progressed and the areas that people are now getting into, it's become a big factor in snowmobiling now to have these backpacks.
What about other types of gear? You mentioned you usually bring a shovel along. Anything else that...
Yep, a shovel.
You might not think of bringing around here.
Yeah, a shovel. And, you know, basically when I look at it, when you go out there, you need to plan for the worst. You need to be planning to spend a night or two or more if you were to get stranded out there. So we bring first aid kits. We bring fire starting material. You know, there's a lot of safety items that you put in just if you have to stay. We have tunnel packs on the snowmobiles to put extra gear and extra gloves, you know, some extra liners of clothes if you have to spend a night out there.
And what about, you know, some of the regulations and laws? Are there some that kind of stand out to you that you should think about before you head out there? Anything different? You know, like, are there access fees and things like that?
you know, the biggest thing is it's just like as far as fees and whatnot, it's, you buy a license for whatever state you're riding in. Just like if you were to go to Michigan or Wisconsin, you buy a season pass to put on your sled. Beyond that, the main thing is just to, you know, look at the trail maps, look at the acreage maps for these sites you're going to be riding. The Forest Service usually has them marked off fairly well as far as they're sometimes divided into motorized and non-motorized. You know, a lot of the riding that we do, it takes place on federal forest land or state land. In Colorado, for example, they've really divvied it up almost 50-50 as far as their usable acreage to motorized, non-motorized. So you got your cross-country skiers, your snowshoers that have access to part of the grounds, and then you know, the snowmobilers, you know, have that. So they're strict on that. You need to make sure you know where they're going. The boundaries are usually marked, but it's not always perfect. But you know, you can usually get some maps. Excuse me. You usually can get some maps that'll help out with that.
As you access these state lands and federal lands, and you've talked about how the mountain snowmobiling is starting to grow in popularity, is there still enough land? When you're out there with a group, do you usually see other people or just your group?
It varies. The amount of land to ride on, it really is massive. You know, there's some areas that are more condensed and a little more popular than others, but, you know, you'll start off, so Steamboat, Colorado, for example, there's some public parking areas that we usually park at to unload the sleds, and you'll see a ton of guys up there unloading for the day, but as people disperse and ride off into the backcountry, you know, there's a lot of days where we don't see another machine besides our group for the whole day.
You had talked earlier that this is physically demanding. Talk a little bit more about that. I mean, Andy and I are in pretty good shape, but say it's somebody that's not as in quite as good a shape as we are.
Not a peak performance athlete?
Yes. What would they be kind of running into? Why is it demanding?
You know, it's just once you get off the trail and you're maneuvering through deep snow, you're using a ton of upper and lower body strength to turn the machine, you know, to change directions. You know, oftentimes you're fighting steep grades and having to side hill the machine, and it just takes a lot of physical strength. And you know, even the gear you're wearing, we're usually sweating, you're getting warm doing this, and between that and just being up at high elevation, it's you're breathing heavy, it's hard to catch your breath, you know, especially after if you have to dig somebody out and get stuck, and then you're really exerting a ton of energy moving all that snow. You know, it catches up with you after a while. You know, and you don't really get a chance to cool off and take it easy like you would on the trail. You're kind of on the trail, you're blazing down, and you might even get cold doing that, but it's completely opposite. And if you get stuck and your buddies can't find you for a while, you're going to have to do most of the digging and expend a bunch of energy doing that.
You know, most of my riding is not only around here, but northern Minnesota, but it seemed like we always had this one guy in the group that no matter where, he was the one that would get stuck. do you run into that with your group at all that you have?
I mean, it happens from time to time. I won't give out any names, but yeah, it happens, especially when, you know, people go out there that haven't done it before. Right. I mean, I remember the first time that I went, I mean, yeah, it was a struggle. It was an eye opener, you know, and you learn a little bit each time how to avoid getting stuck. And mainly just once you know you're going to get stuck, how to minimize it. There's ways you can make it 10 times worse. And when you're new at it, that's usually when it happens.
Well, take us out west. What are some of the places you've gone to, some of your favorite places, any place you wouldn't recommend?
Yeah, so far, I guess...
lots of questions right
there. Yeah, no, favorite place so far, Cook City, Montana. Cook City gets a little bit of a bad rap because of the avalanche danger that can be present there. There's some pretty aggressive terrain.
So that's near Beartooth?
Yep, Beartooth Mountains. And it's a unique place. It's some incredible riding. Like I said, it gets a little bit of a bad rap, but it's only as bad as you make it. There's plenty of terrain there that's safe to ride, that you don't have to get yourself into those situations. But it's a unique place. It's a bit of a drive from here. You have to snake down through Yellowstone Park. There's one way in and one way out in the winter. And access is a little tougher, but that's my favorite place we've been. Hoping to go back later this winter. We've done a lot of riding out in Montana, Wyoming, and Colorado. A little bit into Idaho too. You know, those are the kind of the four really big riding states as far as this sport goes. You know, even Utah, Northern California, Washington State, there's some excellent riding there. We haven't ventured quite that far yet because we really haven't had to, but you know, those are places we've gone. You know, as far as places I wouldn't recommend, I haven't been anywhere yet that I'd say just don't go there. It's so dependent on snow. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, we chase it around. You know, last year there was so much snow in Montana. Now this year it's lower, and we're going somewhere else until things catch up later. So, you know, it's, if they got big snow, you're going to have fun either way, no matter what the location is.
And as far as these different locations, you know, there's obviously a cost of loading up and driving, pulling a trailer out there, licenses, those type of costs. But what can a person expect to pay for a motel? And how big a variance is there on that?
You know, it varies a lot, just depending some of these locations. You know, Steamboat, for example, we've been out there. That's a little bit more of an expensive place to go than, say, some of the places in Montana. You know, we were there between Christmas and New Year's just this past holiday, and I think we paid almost $200 a night for a pretty low-end motel, and that was kind of the going rate there. But, you know, usually if we have a bigger group, we'll try to rent a cabin or a house off of an Airbnb or a VRBO. You know, it might be $250 a night, but if we get a group of five over the course of the trip, that's, you know, not a bad way to split up the cost.
And how far in advance do you typically make reservations, or do you wait till you get out there to make reservations, take a chance?
Well, we definitely try to get it done in advance. That's the hardest thing with this kind of riding is, you know, if you're really chasing the big snow, you know, it's hard to book something a month or more in advance, because, you know, typically when we go, we watch the weather, watch the radar, and when a place gets hit big snow, we usually try to go within, you know, a few days or a week or something of that time. So it's a little all over the board as far as getting things booked.
And what about breakdowns? Do you typically know where different dealers are if you got to get a sled in? Is that something you check before you go, or do you kind of do it yourself? Yeah, think you can kind of take,
you know,
care.
It's always
what would you recommend to the average person?
A lot of the places, the popular riding areas, a lot of the towns, they have dealerships there. A lot of them have rental, snowmobile rental shops too, and they carry a lot of parts. You know, we work on our stuff ourselves as much as we can, but there's times when you might need something. So, you know,
but you're pretty mechanically inclined, I would say. Above average.
I'd like to think so, but, you know, it doesn't always work out. But, you know, some of these locations, we've been to a few areas that there aren't shops, there aren't dealerships. We stayed at a resort in the Bighorns, Wyoming last winter, where we were up way up top on this little mountain lodge, and there was nothing within 30 miles. So you're kind of at your own mercy there. I mean, you know, we carry some spare parts with, but you can't anticipate everything. I mean, snowmobiles are inherent to breaking down, and that's just part of it.
So what would be some typical spare parts that you'd want to bring on a trip like that?
You know, for the mountain sleds, I try to carry a set of A-arms with front suspension arms. Usually leave them in the trailer. That sounds kind of major, but out there, if you hit a stump or you hit a rock under the snow, it doesn't take much to end your trip as far as that goes. You know, otherwise, you know, your regular supplies, your spare belts, you know, usually try to keep, you know, nuts and bolts, a lot of different sizes, just because, you know, sometimes you have to make emergency repairs and just doctor it up enough to get the machine back.
And as you talk about, you know, working on it yourself and setting it up because of altitude changes, what's the highest altitude that you've ridden at?
So far, the highest I've been up is about 12,000 feet. You know, in a lot of the good riding areas, I mean, you know, last year we were riding a lot West Yellowstone and more down in the 8,000-9,000 range. You know, early season this year, we had to chase some higher stuff out in Colorado to find the snow. But, yeah, you know, like, again, it's just small adjustments between different altitude ranges.
Yep. And yeah, that does add to your physical exertion too. I know when I go out west skiing, like in Breckenridge, and you're up 14,000 feet,
right?
You get tired real quick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Even though we are in peak shape, yeah. You know, it can sneak up on us.
We're used to that heavy Midwestern air.
Yeah. Any in your group ever got altitude sickness at all?
No, surprisingly not. You know, there's a few cases where usually on day one, and if you're helping guys get unstuck, we have, you know, a few cases where guys have gotten a little bit lightheaded, and you just kind of take a break for a while, but we haven't had anything severe, thankfully.
So you're going to try and head back out west again? Yeah, you got already two trips under your belt. Going to try to get another one in yet this winter?
Yep, I got a couple more, for sure, a couple more in the works, so kind of just got a few things coming up the next couple of weeks, but I'd like to get out late January, early February again. And, you know, the springtime riding is really good out there also. You know, they have a long season out there. You know, there's times where guys are riding long into April, even early May, wow, if guys really want to do it. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity to get out there if you want to do some riding in the spring.
Frustrating around here, unless you've headed north. You haven't had your snowmobile out yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the thing that worries me is, are we going to be getting dumped on in April?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, it could be a repeat of last year. Yeah. It's shockingly similar so far.
So, well, anything else, Jeremy? Anything that people should really kind of think about before they just go out and buy a mountain sled?
You know, again, I mean, it's a big commitment. It's a pretty big investment, you know, to do that. So, you know, people that are interested in it, you know, I've made the recommendation a lot of times that if you come out, there's a lot of rental agencies out there. You can rent brand new sleds and, you know, give it a try for your first time instead of spending a ton of money on a new sled or a mountain machine that you may or may not really enjoy. You can go out there and try it. You know, the rental fees are usually around $250 a day with insurance. They'll even rent out gear. They'll rent out avalanche beacons. They'll rent out really anything you need. So, I mean, that's something, you know, for somebody that's looking to just get their feet wet and see if it's for them or not, definitely recommend that before jumping in all the way. There's plenty of opportunities to do that.
Andy and I wanted to head out next weekend. We suggest we just call and reserve and then...
Yeah.
Some front sleds and
certainly.
Are there places that'll send you out with a guide?
Oh yes. Right. Yep. There's guide service available. You know, they charge you, it's usually around $100 a day or maybe a little more for a group guided trip. And that's a, you know, that's a good way too. If you're in unfamiliar territory, it's a quick way to get back. They'll usually get you back places where you won't see another snowmobiler for the rest of the day.
All right. Okay. Well, you've been listening to Jeremy Hewlett on KYMN 95.1, the one, and 1080 AM on Northfield Outdoors. Jeremy, that's a lot of information that, but it sounds like you really enjoy doing that. Do you miss the motorcycle racing? I mean, you still get out and ride.
I still ride for fun. I haven't raced for a couple years, but I don't miss the racing anymore. I mean, I loved it, but I'm kind of over that now, and you know, this is what I'm doing now is what I always wanted to do, and it's just kind of come to fruition. But you know, I'll always do both sports at some degree, but you know, even back in my day when I was really racing a lot and that was my number one focus, I still always loved snowmobiling more. That's the first thing I ever really got introduced to when I was a kid.
All right, well, this has been very interesting. I know that sounds like a good time to me. I just think we should plan a trip, but we do still have a little bit of time left for Dave's Interesting Facts.
Well, of course, we've been talking snowmobiles. This is where I test Andy's knowledge on the subject, because I know he spends a lot of show prep going through trying to find this. So,
let's see,
Jeremy, we'll let you join in, but we'll test Andy's knowledge first.
Sounds good.
Andy, any idea how many snowmobiles are registered in the U.S.?
Oh, jeez. I am going to go with 500,000.
No, that's close to what's registered in Canada. That's 600,000, but that's incorrect.
Oh, I thought you said north of the U.S. Crap.
Jeremy, you want to take a shot at this one?
I really wouldn't have a clue, but let's go 250,000.
No, let's go 1.2 million.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's still a lot of old sleds out there.
Yeah, I guess.
Do you know what the average age of the average snowmobiler is?
42.
Boy, you're actually pretty close.
You look very surprised.
Yes, I am. It's actually 45. The age has been getting older and stuff. The average snowmobiler rides snowmobiles how many miles per year in North America?
Well, I'm guessing, as Jeremy earlier was saying, putting on 3,000 miles a year, that's going to be way higher than the average.
You are correct
so far. So I'm going to guess 250.
Well, now that we know the incorrect answer, Jeremy, you ought to shoot for one?
I'd say closer to 1,000.
Close. 1,250 miles per year.
Okay.
Is what the average one puts on that. In the year 2018, how many snowmobiles were sold worldwide?
Oh, God. Good one, Dave.
So this is
worldwide. 1.6 million.
No, that's you're really, really
I
way
usually
off.
Am.
This number surprised me, considering how many were registered. Any idea, Jerry?
Yeah, new units. I mean, I would have to guess it's a lot lower than that, maybe 250,000.
Well, you're a lot closer. It's 124,786 snowmobiles were sold.
Okay. I was also including, you know, used sales.
Oh, no, no.
You have to be more clear with your questions.
Okay. Well, how many were sold in the U.S.?
38,000.
Not bad, but you're wrong.
It's I usually am. Like
53,179. Okay, we'll give you one last shot here.
Thank you.
How many full-time jobs are generated by the snowmobile industry in North America? And this includes manufacturing, dealerships, and tourism related directly to snowmobiles.
I love your questions, Dave.
He's not letting you off easy here.
No.
Well, I thought this was a pretty easy one. And you don't have to be precise, but extremely close.
50,000.
No, you're
way
really,
off.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, now that we have the incorrect answer again. Oh,
I have no clue, but I'll go with 150,000.
It's actually 100,000. Just a little over 100,000 full-time jobs.
Split our answers in half, and there you go. Yep.
Yes, there you go. That's today's interesting facts.
Well, Dave, you started off the new year right. Well, we'd like to thank you for listening and also remind you to tune in next week to Northfield Outdoors. You're tuning in this week to Northfield Outdoors.
Yes.
Tune in next
Hopefully
week
you're listening.
On Tap with Corey and Ira and find out how they are kicking off the new year with beer. As always, this show will be archived on KYMNradio.net and found under Northfield Outdoors. And thank you to Hayes for updating the Northfield Outdoors Facebook page, and to Professional Pride Realty for sponsoring Northfield Outdoors. And Dave, until next time.
As always, get out there and enjoy the great outdoors, folks. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Northfield Outdoors with Dave Vesladol and Andy Behem, brought to you by Professional Pride Realty. Join Dave and Andy every other Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on 95 The One or streaming at kymnradio.net.